Blog Talk Radio.
Full Fill Radio, a voice you can trust. Broadcasting live presents Two Guys and a Bible with Don Preston and William Bell. Join us each week at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central as we bring you exciting, sound, challenging, and comforting messages regarding the end times. Thank you for tuning in today. Don Preston is the founder of Preterist Research Institute, or PRI. Don is a prolific author, having written and published 19 books, a host of audio and DVD studies, and is a debater and defender of the full preterist view. His websites are BibleProphecy.com, Eschatology.org, and DonKPreston.com. William Bell is the founder of AllThingsFulfilled.com Ministries and has a website bearing the same name, and has authored 3 books, audios, and DVDs. He has published hundreds of articles and recordings. And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Two Guys and a Bible broadcast with Don Preston and William Bell.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Two Guys and a Bible right here on Fulfill Radio, a voice you can trust. I'm William Bell. We're glad to be back this week. And with me, of course, is Don Preston. Don, how are you doing and how is everything over in the western part of the country? Oh, Midwestern, I guess I should say.
Yeah, doing okay, William. And it's good to know that you're feeling better. I know that you were just pretty under the weather. This old flu junk is just sweeping everywhere. I keep knocking on wood. Just hoping that I can continue to escape it. My wife got on my case, said, "You're going to take the flu shot. You're going to take the flu shot." And I said, "I don't want the flu shot." Well, come to find out, the flu shot that I got is not even for the strain of flu that's sweeping through Ardmore.
Right.
Or the nation. So, I just try to stay away from people. I try to use a little hand cleanser, all that kind of stuff. I've got a bottle of it virtually everywhere I go. But you know how it goes. It's almost inescapable. It's just almost inescapable.
Well, I couldn't escape it. Leora couldn't escape it. And I talked to one of my business friends today, and she and her husband had it too.
Yeah. Well, as you well know, I've been holding some regular Bible studies with a local minister here in Ardmore, and he texted me late last night and said, "I'm really sorry, but I've got to cancel out. The flu bug is sweeping through my family," and he said, "I've got to run errands to the doctor all day tomorrow to the different doctor appointments." So, like I said, it's just absolutely everywhere. Can't seem to escape it. I keep expecting almost every day to feel that, to feel the onslaught. I try not to be paranoid, but boy, it's everywhere.
Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, you'll miss it and won't have to deal with it, because I tell you, it was nothing pleasant. And, you know, my granddaughter, actually, I'm not sure she has it, but she got very sick when she left on Sunday after we came from, you know, worship. And so, but I think she's back up on her feet. I'm hopeful that she is. But we, we had a run in our family, and so.
Well,
but
Jan
I'm back
had
and,
it when we. Yeah, Jan had it when we got back from Arkansas over the holidays, and was sick. Bless her heart, she was sick. And I did my best to baby her and take good care of her, and I guess I did. She recovered from it. But I just basically figured, well, you know, I mean, you got somebody in the house that's got the flu. It's inevitable that you're going to catch the flu, but I didn't. So I feel
well,
very,
good for you.
Very fortunate.
Well, good. All right.
Yes, sir.
Well, we're back. We missed a week. That's unusual for us. Not to
yes.
be on the air every week, and so I want to thank our listeners for being patient with us and understanding, you know, the illness that was going on, as well as, you know, other things. But we are back tonight, and I'm sure there's some good studies lined up on the little apocalypse in Isaiah.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
So tell me, I know you've been engaged in some pretty interesting studies online as well. I kind of go in and peek and look at, you know, what's happening. I can't see much sometimes because, you know, like I said, I've been swamped with just business stuff on top of the illness and just trying to get some of that straightened out. And seemingly I finally poked my head above water with a lot of it today.
Well, that's good. Yeah, there's been some really good discussions going on Facebook. You know, that's the fantastic thing about Facebook and YouTube is that you just hear from so many different people. Sometimes you hear from some perspectives that you just shake your head at it and you just go, is there any connection with logic here? Is there a connection with reality here? And so you have to kind of pick and choose to a certain extent. pardon me. There's some of the most unscholarly, unthoughtful, illogical stuff that floats around on the internet under the guise of people being Bible students that, again, you just literally have to shake your head at, and you marvel that anyone could be convinced by it. Furthermore, you're not only amazed that someone would come up with something so ridiculous, so off the wall, but then you're completely and totally amazed that anyone else would ever be convinced by it. And so every once in a while, you have to spend a little bit of time. I try not to spend a lot of my time with that type of thing. I try to deal with the topics and the themes and the subjects that have merit, that have been and continue to be topics of discussion. This afternoon, for instance, someone posted that there's going to be a debate between a Seventh-day Adventist and a Church of Christ preacher late this month. They were asking for some input on that. Well, William, as you know, I've been working on a book on the Sabbath for a good long while, and so I posted some comments in regard to that. I'm not quite sure, to be honest about it, I am not quite sure how many people grasped the point that I was trying to make, so I may have to write it again and develop it a little bit more. But this is an area that as you and I have discussed, the entire Sabbatarian issue is absolutely fundamental to eschatology, and yet in eschatological discussions, it's one of the most ignored topics that's out there. And yet, interestingly enough, D.A. Carson, in his book, From Sabbath to Sunday, which is a compendium of different authors on the Sabbath issue, one of the authors, Richard Baucom, a well-known scholar of modern day, he says there is no clear consensus in the early church writings about the Sabbath. Now, we know that they worshiped on Sunday, but there is ambiguity in their remarks about the Sabbath itself. A little bit later on, you see anti-Sabbatarian stuff going on, but it's a fascinating topic, and one that, again, in this book that I'm writing, I'm developing it in a way, and I'm really thrilled about the research that I'm doing. And I've been in correspondence with a guy who was at one time very, very high up, one of the leading evangelists in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but who studied himself out of it. But he has admitted to me in correspondence that he knows that his presuppositions that he carried with him from Sabbatarianism still guide his eschatology. And he told me, he said, I'm willing to listen to what you have to say. And I told him, I said, well, I think I've got some things to say on the Sabbath that are not only going to reinforce your reasons for leaving the Sabbatarian view, but are going to really be challenging to you and give you further reason for abandoning it. But it's going to challenge where you're at also right now in your futurist eschatology. So
very excited. I have to step out. Yes. I'm sorry to interrupt you for just a minute because we have Daniel online who has a couple of quick questions he'd like to ask.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and put him through. Why don't you take his question while I cough because I still got a little congestion going on here, okay?
Okay.
All right. Welcome, Daniel.
Daniel,
you're
there?
On the air.
Hello,
all
Daniel.
Right. Yes, sir. I have two quick questions. I don't want to take too much of your time. Sorry to bother you. I know last week you both were out, so I'm sure you have things to catch up on. Who is this Babylon? In the section where you write about the time statements, one of your key arguments in defense for the time statements of imminency in the New Testament is if those words at hand coming quickly, if they don't really mean that, why would the Spirit convey those words? Why are they even there? Which I believe is a good argument. Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate with you. I'm going to take off my preterist hat and put on my futurist hat.
Go right ahead.
And so in regard to that, and you can ask for clarity more on the question. In regard to that, if somebody says, well, one day is 1,000 years, 1,000 years is a day, and they try to mitigate those time statements, and then your argument is, well, if at hand doesn't mean at hand, then why would the Spirit convey that word? Now, I want to ask, in regard to the parousia of Christ itself, there are many passages where it says, every eye will see him, they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. If Jesus was to be revealed in the Shekinah glory of the Father, then why would the New Testament writers use those phrases like every eye will see him, they'll see this, see that, coming in flaming fire? Why would they use those words if it doesn't really mean he'd come back in a physical body?
Okay, very, very good. Pardon me. William, I'd step away to cough, and I didn't get to step away to cough. So I'll do the best that I can.
Okay. I wouldn't mind hearing an answer from both of you, by the way.
Okay, well, when he gets back, I'll be when William steps back in here, we'll be more than happy to have his thoughts because I'm sure they'll be excellent. And it's a very fair question there, Daniel. First of all, let me make an observation that those who seek to mitigate the time statements of imminence do not seek to negate the time statements of protraction or delay.
Right.
And here's... You know, so they go to passages that say at hand, quickly, shortly, and they say, oh, well, that doesn't mean anything. But then they go over, like Kenneth Gentry does, for instance, in Matthew chapter 25, where the master gave talents to his servants and went away for a long way, and they go, for a long time. And they say, ah, see, long time. It's got to mean a long time. Well, wait a minute. If at hand cannot mean at hand, then how do we know a long time means a long time? Maybe
right.
A long time means shortly, you know, something. But secondly, more specifically to your question, it's a very natural question. I asked the question of myself years and years ago, and that is that we have to recognize the nature of apocalyptic language as used in the Hebraic Bible. In other words, when we find a consistent pattern of what is known as decreation language, the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give its light, the stars shall fall from heaven, that from the very beginning of its usage is metaphoric, okay? That,
right.
When we go to the prophetic books and we see there a consistent, unbroken consistency of metaphoric use of that language, and then we come to the New Testament passages that use the identical language, and in fact, the New Testament writers tell us that they're looking for what the Old Testament prophets said. Okay, here's what the Old Testament prophets said, here's how they used the language, etc. So when we come to the New Testament, the New Testament writers use the exact same language as the Old Testament prophets did. Matter of fact, they quote from the Old Testament prophets.
Right.
Then consistency of language would suggest I would say, yes, it demands that we take the language being used by the New Testament writers in the same identical way and manner that the Old Testament prophets use them. And by the way, let me give you a real quick prime example of this. The coming of the day of the Lord of 2 Peter chapter 3 would be in fulfillment of the Old Covenant prophets. That's what Peter says in 2 Peter chapter 3, 1 and 2. That he was writing to remind his audience of what the Old Covenant prophets had written. So he talks about the day of the Lord, talks of coming about the coming of the new heaven and new earth according to his promise. Where do we find the promise of the new heaven and new earth? Well, we find it in Isaiah 64 to 66. So here's what I want you to notice. The day of the Lord of of 2 Peter chapter 3, to bring in the new heaven and new earth, would be in fulfillment of Isaiah 64 to 66. Isaiah 64, 1 to 3, specifically says that this coming of the Lord to bring in the new creation that he's talking about would be a day of the Lord as the Lord had come before. Isaiah 64, 1 to 3. But the Lord had never come literally, visibly, and bodily out of heaven before. Therefore, the coming of the Lord to bring in the new heaven and new earth of 2 Peter chapter 3, being the fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 64 to 66, and Isaiah 64 to 66 specifically stating that it would be a day of the Lord as former days of the Lord, guess what?
Right.
There's our hermeneutic. There's how we answer the question, well, okay, if the New Testament writers wanted to express a literal, visible, bodily coming of Christ, then what other words could they have expressed? Well, yes, taken from a modern, Western, Occidental perspective, a Grecian perspective, we can very well ask that question. The question is that the way the biblical writers use the language? And the unequivocal answer is, they never use the language that way. And Isaiah 64 to 66 unequivocally defines the nature of the day of the Lord to bring in a new heaven and new earth as to be of the same nature as prior days of the Lord.
Right.
So
okay.
It's a contrast. Stuff. It's a contrast, Daniel, between the both Old Testament and New Testament writers using time words prosaically, literally. You know, they when God told Daniel, Daniel, your vision of the end time, your vision of the resurrection, your vision of the great tribulation, etc., is for many days off. Go your way. You will sleep with your fathers. In the last days, this will happen. Oh, well, how much clearer could that be? Daniel, you're going to die. This is not for your day. That's not metaphoric language. You're going
right.
to die, Daniel. It's not for you. But it is for the last days. The New Testament writers say, the Old Testament writers were told those events were not for their day, they're for our day. 1 Peter chapter 1, 10 to 12. So again, we have to allow the Bible to interpret its own language, to define its own words. When we do, this language of the day of the Lord coming on the clouds with fire, you know, with the angels, with the sound of a trumpet, with shout, hailstorm, blah, blah, blah. All that's invariably metaphoric. Time
right.
statements are not invariably metaphoric.
Okay. Because I know a big deal that is made with people not believing the truth of covenant eschatology. For example, in your debate with Michael Brown, he asked the question, so you think that Jesus has already come in flaming fire? Well, he has to know that the time statements in the New Testament force the coming of the Lord in the first century. But because of the nature, he has that wrong. So therefore,
he actually said
that.
If you'll remember, he actually said that when I went across Peter's hermeneutic in 1 Peter chapter 1, the New Testament writers sought to know the time and manner, and that they, through the Holy Spirit, were being shown that the time had arrived and that the manner was spiritual. He said they got the time right, but they did not get the manner correctly.
Right.
I mean, and that's stunning stuff.
Yeah, it
Go ahead,
is.
William.
I was just going to add one little point to what you said, and because it's very good for people to acknowledge the nature of how God came in the Old Covenant, and then to also recognize that this is apocalyptic language. And I would just add to that the concepts which are found in the Old Testament when you're studying it, and particularly one of the chapters I've always used, are actually two of them, and one is Exodus and the other one is Ezekiel, because they basically demonstrate what Ladd called, and I just kind of hung on his words, you know, because I liked the way he phrased it, G.E. Ladd. But one of the things that he said was that there were what's called redemptive revelatory events. In other words, not just simple history that was occurring in the scriptures, but this is redemptive revelatory history, revelations that had to do with God's redemptive program. And if you just take the time to read the book of Exodus, which I know we all have, you will find, and particularly during the time of the plagues, where God would make a declaration about something he would do, and he would even give time statements in certain of those examples, and said, you know, tomorrow about this time, when such and such occurs, then you will know that I am the Lord. So we have these statements that reveal who God is through events. And that's what that apocalyptic language is about. And sometimes, you know, in the book of Ezekiel and even in the New Testament, they will use the words seeing, which is another way of perceiving and knowing something. And so the Old Testament people were very well established in that type of language, as Don has explained before, but they knew that it was through the events that these redemptive, revelatory, and theological revelations would be manifested. And so they would look to the event, the event would occur, and then they would know that something had happened. And if you study, you know, prophecy pretty much throughout the Bible, you will see God using that process over and over again. So passages like Isaiah 19, you know, with the Lord riding upon a swift cloud into Egypt,
right,
would be one
right.
of those examples, and they are just replete throughout the New Testament. It's, as Don said, because of our removal from the genre of the Old Testament and the hermeneutic background that's necessary to understand that language, you know, we get caught up in literalizing the manner, disregarding the time, and then failing to unlock the simple meaning of these passages.
Right.
Let me build on that. Yeah, let me build on that just a little bit more. William touched on it ever so briefly, but he mentioned the book of Ezekiel, pointing out this hermeneutical key of seeing the Lord, that it was in the events, historical events that took place, that the redemptive knowledge was given. 82 times, if my memory serves me correctly and if my account was correct, 82 times in the book of Ezekiel, Yahweh said he was about to do something. That would be bringing judgment on Tyre, on Sidon, on Egypt, on Judah and Jerusalem, et cetera, regardless of what it was. But 82 times, Yahweh said, I'm going to do this that you may know that I am God. So here, the redemptive knowledge of knowing who Yahweh is, his sovereignty, his you know, his majesty, would come not through seeing him personally, even though he said he was going to come in those events, but the knowledge would come through seeing the events themselves happen. And that would be the destruction, as I mentioned, of Egypt, Ezekiel chapter 30, and some other passages. For instance, in Ezekiel 35, he gives a list of 25 nations that he was about to judge through the hand of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. And throughout the chapter, he says, that you may know that I am God. And so this is really, really critical to understand. And I would bring up another text here. In Isaiah 26, part of the little apocalypse that we have been studying, in Isaiah 26:10 and following, the Lord said, Lord, when your judgments are in the earth, the righteous will learn wisdom. But the wicked will see and will not see. And so, pardon me, the point of it is, and even John Calvin made note of this, okay? John Calvin said that what Isaiah was saying was that the righteous and the unrighteous would see the same identical event. The righteous would realize that's the coming of the Lord. The wicked, the unbelievers, would see the same identical event and not know. They would not understand. They would not see that this was the coming of the Lord. Same event. One group of people would see it. Ah, that's the coming of the Lord. Second group of people, what do you mean that's the coming of the Lord? It's nothing but an invasion of Egypt by the Assyrians. Big deal. And the righteous are going, no, but you don't understand. That's the Lord. He was using the Assyrians, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's very, very important. We emphasize this over and over on this program. It is important to use the biblical hermeneutic itself, not to use a modern-day type of hermeneutic that says the Bible says what it means what it says. That is a totally insufficient hermeneutic. It's an improper hermeneutic because it assumes that I know what those words mean or meant to the first century or 5th century B.C. or whatever. It assumes that the coming of the Lord meant to them exactly what it means to us today. When we have 2,000 years of tradition that has taught us wrongly about it, going back to the text of Isaiah 64 to 66. I mean, I was raised believing the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the earth and the elements therein shall be burnt up. I mean, everybody knows that's the end of time. Well, that's not the way the Bible describes the day of the Lord. So that's why we continue to emphasize, let's use the Bible's hermeneutic. And oh, by the way, in case you didn't already know it, Daniel, I did put an announcement on my Facebook page. Dr. Michael Brown and I have an agreement to have another debate. Very excited about that.
And I'm very excited as well because I know I asked you a couple of months ago about that.
And, yes, not only you. The interest in that first debate, William, I don't know if you had seen the numbers or not, but as of a few days ago, that debate has now had over 15,000 views.
That's great. That's great. I suspect that the second one will have even more.
I suspect you're right. I really do. I must say this. No disrespect at all whatsoever, but I've had to continually press and correspond to get an agreement from them for another debate. They didn't answer my emails for a little bit. Then finally they answered my emails and said, well, we're in the midst of a remodeling project. We can't do this now. And yet he continued on with the rest of his broadcasting and production and all that kind of stuff. Well, okay, that's fine. But finally I sent 3 emails in a row and said, look, the interest in a follow-up debate is tremendous. There's no question about it. I keep getting inquiries from people wanting to know, are we ever going to have another debate on, for instance, the fullness of the Gentiles in Romans 11 and the times of the Gentiles in Luke chapter 21? I know the interest is out there, so let's please do this.
Yeah,
and so got a response from his representative and said, yes, we'll be glad to have another debate, but it'll be after March the 10th. So I'm trying to nail down some specific dates at this particular time.
Okay. Let me also add this little comment in to the piece that you were discussing just prior to talking about Dr. Brown, where you were mentioning the fact that there would be occasions where the righteous would see the event and the unrighteous would not see the event. Well, we have that particularly regarding the return of Christ in John chapter 14, where the discussion is the return of Christ, and this is the one that even the dispensationalists agree with in terms of being a, an end-time text. In John 14, you know, with the announcement of the house of God, the tabernacle, etc., the passages that, you know, even those who disagree with us will parallel with 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4, by the way. And yet, in this context, that, you know, I just can't think of too many people who would not lump most of the end time passages, including the major three that they generally hold out on for everything. They'll get it all the way where we believe everything except 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Thessalonians, and John 14, and maybe Revelation 20 sometimes. But in John 14, the text says in verse 22, you know, Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, "Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world?"
Right. Okay.
Well,
I see.
Yeah, if he's coming like everybody assumed he was coming, how can people not see it? I mean, are they going to be blindfolded or something to make them not see it? But that just demonstrates that the type of coming that he's expressing, and this is where he says he's going to make his home with them, he and his father. This is the coming of that new tabernacle that's mentioned in Revelation 21, and of course John 14 as well, which is none other than the coming of 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4, and
right.
Yet he says he would manifest himself to the saints and not to the world. And yet you have a text like every eye shall see him. So that should cause people to really think about the way they're trying to interpret that, because, I mean, I'm sitting here staring at my computer. I can't be looking at it and not looking at it at the same time, even though I know it's possible to daydream, but I mean from a standpoint of physically seeing it, and that should, you know, let people know. Don, you might want to have an additional comment on that, but I just thought that fit right in line with the things you were saying in the Old Testament.
Yeah, I think it fits very well. Another text along with it goes 2 Corinthians chapter 4, where Paul says, we know that our suffering the present time works in us a far more exceeding eternal weight of glory. The outward man is perishing. The inner man is being renewed day by day. We do not look at the things that are seen, the things that are unseen. So this is a direct corollary to this type of seeing and not seeing. You know, here is Paul saying our resurrection hope is not focused on things that are visible. Wow. That ought to make us stop and think. I thought the resurrection was when every biologically decomposed body, the corpse that's ever gone into the grave, is going to come back out. And Paul says, no, we're not looking at the things that are seen. Well,
right.
wouldn't that be a seen event? I think it would be a seen event. But Paul says our resurrection hope of the new man, the resurrection man, that change from the earthly house, which in which they were groaning, looking for the heavenly house, which was in heaven, but it was an unseen thing that they were looking for, which has all sorts of implications. But anyway, I think it's very, very important for us. It gets back to hermeneutic. How does the Bible describe and define all of these issues? We are so focused on seeing with the visible eye. Oh, pardon me.
Right.
Seeing with the visible eye that it's almost as if we have lost our ability to see with the eyes of faith.
Right. Okay.
Daniel, we talked a good little bit on that. Did you have a second question?
I did, yes. Real fast. This is one question that's really been bothering me ever since I came to grips with these things. In Matthew 16:27-28, Jesus uses the word erechomai for coming in that context. But
yes.
Then in Matthew 24,
verse 1 through 3, he says, "Will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age," and that word is parousia. And then
yes.
in 24, verse 30, mm-hmm. there you have the word erechomai again. Are those words
yes.
used synonymously?
They are two different forms of the same concept. Parousia means more presence instead of a verbal action, okay? And virtually all of your lexicons will bring this out. You're talking about erchomai being the action of coming, parousia being the result of, if you please, and that is the presence that is a result of the coming of the erchomai.
I see. Okay. Okay.
Notice also what will be the sign of your present, of your parousia. What will be the sign that you are present? In other words, this gets back to the very things that we've been discussing earlier. what historical events would they be able to see to let them know that Jesus was present? Well, if he was going to come floating out of heaven on a physical cloud in a 5'5" Jewish man's body, wouldn't that be what they would see? Why would they need a sign of that? Because that would be the event that they were visualizing. But you see, once again, it gets back to Jesus coming in the glory of the Father, like the Father had come. It gets back to Isaiah 64, that the coming of the Lord to bring in the new creation would be a day of the Lord as the Lord had come before. And the Lord had never, ever come literally, visibly, or bodily. He had never, a form of Yahweh, so far as we know from the Old Testament, the form of Yahweh had never descended out of heaven, and somebody ever said, looking up at a literal cloud, "Oh, look, that's God." But that's what they want to do with Jesus.
Right.
They want to look up on a cloud. There's a 5'5" Jewish man and say, "Oh, there's Jesus." No. He was going to come as the Father had come. And they were asking, now watch this. Yahweh said that in the destruction of Tyre and Sidon, then you may know that I am God. In the judgment of Jerusalem, then you will know that I am God. Okay? So the historical event of the judgment of Tyre, Sidon, Jerusalem, Edom, Ammon, on and on it goes. The visible destruction and invasion and judgment of those cities and kings and nations was the sign that Yahweh was there. Okay? Here is Jesus predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. And they said, "What will be the sign of your coming?" Well, Jesus said, okay, here's some signs. Abomination of desolation. This gospel must be preached into all the world. Then comes the end. Immediately after the tribulation, they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So it's the same identical kind of language that the historical event pointed to the spiritual presence of Jesus as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I've said this many, many times. I hope people will start grasping the power of it. The parousia and the erchomai, the epiphania, okay? All of these words that are used to speak of the coming of the Lord are never references to draw our attention to Jesus coming as a man. They are to draw our attention to Jesus' sovereign actions, as he himself said in John 5:21-23, "From henceforth, the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son." Now watch this. "In order that all men might honor the Son as they honor the Father. I can do nothing of myself," Jesus said, "but what I see the Father do, I will do likewise." So here is Jesus emphatically stating that the Father was not going to judge. He had given all judgment prerogative to Jesus, and Jesus was going to judge as he had seen the Father judge. I mean, how much clearer could that be? But you don't see that discussed in the commentaries.
Right.
So this gets back to the whole thing that we've been trying to say. And it gets to the issue, well, okay, if the New Testament writers wanted to express the coming of Jesus in a literal manner, what language would they have used? Well, from a Western perspective, they would have used that language. From a Hebraic perspective, they would never have used that language because that's not the language of the coming of the Lord.
Hmm.
When they wanted to describe the coming of the Lord, they talked about historical judgments, with Yahweh being or acting in his sovereignty, controlling those events. And in those historical events, they were to see Yahweh present. Likewise, Jesus said, the Father will not judge. He's given me the judgment prerogative. I'm going to judge as he has judged. I'm going to come in the glory of the Father. And as Paul would say in 1 Timothy chapter 6, 15 and following, that Jesus in his time, and more specifically, in the divinely appointed time, would manifest who is the only true God, the King of Kings, and the Lord of Lords. That would be the purpose and the definition of the parousia of Christ. Not the coming of Jesus, once again, as a 5'5" Jewish man, but Jesus acting as the Father had acted. In the same manner, in the same way, by using his judgment prerogative to use this nation to judge this nation. And I that's just so critical. Okay?
All righty. Sounds good. Thank you very much for addressing those questions, taking the time to do that.
Well, you're certainly welcome, Daniel. Thank you for listening. Be sure to share with your friends, you know, to tune in every Tuesday night to Two Guys in a Bible. And let them know that we're here. And we love answering questions like this. We love to have feedback from our audience. We love to hear from our audience. So, like I said, be sure to share the news, share the word with everyone, and have them tune in with you.
All righty, will do.
Thanks a lot, Daniel.
All right, thanks, Daniel.
Thanks again.
I feel like I'm about to lose my voice here. But
yeah.
But really, those are some really excellent questions from Daniel, and I know that they're questions that a lot of people have when they examine. And I should point out also, by the way, a couple of weeks ago, a fellow sent me an email, and he said, Don, I've been corresponding with some dispensational guys, and they say that they have completely discounted. They've been able to completely mitigate the time statements of Scripture. And here are the verses that they are using. And he said, number one, is it true? Number two, would you mind addressing these verses? And there was a fairly long list of verses that the dispensationalist that he had been corresponding with, they had thrown by him. And so I promised him that I would write a series of articles responding to those verses, examining those verses, looking at the context, and illustrating why the dispensationalists are completely abusing and misusing these texts in their efforts to mitigate the imminence of the Bible. And so I posted the very first of those articles on eschatology.org this morning. So I want to urge everyone to go over there and take a look at that. The very first article will deal with some of the things we talked about on tonight's program, as a matter of fact, and I think you'll find those things helpful. There'll be a little bit repetition of what we've talked about tonight, but you'll begin to really grasp the importance of what we've talked about tonight.
Well, okay, we've had some great questions and some great answers, I think, to those questions, and they continue to follow the pattern of what we've been talking about in Isaiah 24 as an overall theme, because it's dealing with the nature of the day of the Lord, And so I know we have about 15 minutes left to go in the broadcast this afternoon or this evening. So why don't we just pick up from there, Don? Why don't you kind of start us?
Yes, I definitely wanted to touch back on what we have been discussing in our earlier programs as we try to bring our study of the Little Apocalypse to its close, and that is this issue of blindness and the refusal to see that is pointed out in Isaiah chapter 29. Excuse me. In Isaiah 29:13, the Lord says, "This people draws near to me with their mouth, with their lips they do honor me, but they have removed their heart far from me. And the fear toward me is taught by the precept of man. Therefore, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among the people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of the prudent men shall be hidden." Here is an understanding and a wisdom that was held and would be held by the people at the time Yahweh is talking about, that would refuse to see, would refuse to understand. Now, I called attention to the fact that this blindness motif, and by the way, folks, if you've got a good a computer study program, let me urge you that you just do a study of the word eyes, see, seeing, hear, not hearing, deaf, etc. Just look up all the different forms of that concept just in the book of Isaiah, okay? I mean, you can expand it, certainly, but I'm telling you, if you will focus on just the book of Isaiah, it will blow your mind. It will open your eyes. A little bit of a pun there. because what you will see is, number one, a hearkening back to the song of Moses, Deuteronomy 32, 26 and following, in which Yahweh said, "This is a people of no understanding. This is a people that refuse to hear." So you'll first of all find a hearkening back to the song of Moses, and thus you will see how the song of Moses permeates the message of Isaiah. And what you'll also find is you'll find that those echoes from the Song of Moses are being utilized in messianic prophecies of the last days. And that's absolutely amazing. And you will find that some of those passages are picked up on by Jesus. This passage in Isaiah 29, "These people draws near to me with their mouth, and they're with their lips they do honor me, but their hearts are far from me." Matthew chapter 15, Jesus cites that specifically and verbatim to apply it to Israel of his day. Now watch this. I'll get this right in a minute. I'm sitting here looking at it. In Acts chapter 28, Paul is in Rome. And he calls the leaders of the synagogue to study with him. And I'm going to begin reading with verse 23. "When they had appointed him a day, there came many to him into his lodging, to whom he expounded and testified the kingdom of God, persuading them concerning Jesus, both out of the law of Moses, out of the prophets, from morning until evening. And some believed the things which were spoken, and some believed not. And when they agreed not among themselves, they departed. After that, Paul had spoken one word," and here's the word, "Well spake the Holy Spirit by Isaiah the prophet unto our fathers, saying, Go unto this people and say, Hearing you shall hear and shall not understand, and seeing you shall see and not perceive. For the heart of this people is waxed gross, their ears are dull of hearing, their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their heart, and should be converted, and I should heal them. Be it known therefore unto you that the salvation of God is sent unto the Gentiles, and they will hear it. So here is Paul essentially closing out his ministry, and he's dealing with the recalcitrant leaders of the synagogue in Rome, which, of course, is part of the diaspora. And he's saying to them, you know, guys, if you reject this, you have to understand that what's happening here is what Isaiah foretold when he sent, or when Yahweh sent Isaiah to the prophet or to the people and said, this people's heart is waxed gross. They've closed their eyes, they've closed their ears, lest they see, lest they hear, be converted and be converted and be healed. And by the way, in Isaiah chapter 6, which is where this is taken from, of course, the Lord said, well, Lord, how long do I go proclaim this message about the hardness of their hearts, the blindness of their eyes, the deafness of their ears? How long, you know, how long do you want me to preach against that? And the Lord said, until every city is laid waste. What do you think is happening in Acts chapter 28? When Paul speaks to the leaders of the synagogues in Rome, and he says, William, I found this remarkable as I look at this. I mean, how could Jewish unbelief in Rome lead to the destruction of Jerusalem? But that's exactly what Isaiah was saying. And that's how Paul is applying it. How does that work?
That would be one of those questions that when we get, you know, what in the world does Jewish influence in Thessalonica or Rome, as you say, or any of the other cities, that would be one of the questions that needs to be laid back at their feet based on that text.
Absolutely. You know, we have here something, folks, that lots and lots and lots of people today still don't get, and unfortunately, even some people in the preterist movement do not get. What we have is corporate identity, corporate responsibility, corporate guilt being expressed. Because otherwise, how could Paul ever say to the Jews of the synagogue in Rome, how could he ever cite and apply a prophecy of the judgment on Jerusalem and say, if you guys don't obey, this is what's going to happen? Well, I mean, after all, they're 1,500 miles away. But you see, they feel that corporate identity. They understand corporate guilt. But this has to do with, of course, what Jesus had to say in Matthew 24:14. This gospel of the kingdom in all of the nations, or into all of the world, excuse me, as a witness to the nations, then comes the end. I mean, here's Paul telling the Jews in Rome, they have a corporate responsibility to the Jews in Jerusalem, their brethren, their nation, their people, their body, to accept this. Because if they don't accept it, and if their brethren throughout the rest of the empire don't accept it, that judgment was coming on the nation. And I was corresponding just this last week, William, with somebody. He said, well, I just don't get how you could say that the judgment on Jerusalem was, a universal deal. And I pointed, well, in AD 66, at the very beginning of the outbreak of the war in Alexandria, Egypt, for crying out loud, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, the Egyptians attacked the Jews because of insurrections, and they killed 50,000 Jews in one day. Now, I don't think there's any way that you could say, therefore, that the war was a, quote, strictly local event, unquote, when you got 50,000 people, Jews, being slain in one single day. That's not very local to me. And Josephus just lifts city after city after city after city in which tens of thousands of Jews were killed during this outbreak of the Jewish war. Now, these were, and by the way, these are not Judean cities. These are cities scattered throughout the entirety of the Roman Empire. We just have to grasp how widespread, may I use the term, how universal that war truly was. So, this brings us back to this blindness concept of how the New Testament writers, picking up this motif from the book of Isaiah, picking up the motif from the little apocalypse. What did we see back in Isaiah chapter 27? This is a people of no understanding. So what did God say? The one who created them will have no mercy on them. And this would happen in the day, Yahweh said, in which I will make the fortified city a desolation. I will turn the altar of the temple into chalk stone. And, of course, chalk stone just crumbles. So this concept of blindness that would lead to the refusal of the word of Yahweh, that's what was happening all throughout the book of Isaiah. Here is Torah being taught to Israel, Torah being appealed to, and them being warned if they do not obey Torah, judgment is coming. So what's happening in the New Covenant time? They're being told, you need to follow Jesus because that's what Moses said. To obey Jesus is to obey Torah. To disobey Jesus, to not accept him, is to disobey Moses, and therefore Torah. Therefore judgment would come. You know, and that's exactly what Paul said in Acts chapter 13, as he is in the synagogue of Antioch of Pisidia. He stands up and he preaches to the Jews, and he, pardon me, he gave them fair warning in verse in Acts 13, 40 and 41. Beware, pardon me, beware you scoffers and you despisers, for behold, I work a work in your day that a man would not believe even if it were told unto him. He's quoting verbatim from Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5, in which the prophet was saying to Jerusalem and Judah in the 6th century B.C., if you reject the word of the Lord, the Babylonians are coming. They're going to desolate this city. They're going to destroy this people. And so here is Paul speaking to the Jews in Antioch of Pisidia, and we raise again the question, well, why in the world would he say things like this to people that were literally hundreds and hundreds of miles away from Jerusalem? It's because of corporate guilt, because of corporate identity, because Israel was one body. You see, we have to understand body concept from the Jewish perspective, not from the modern perspective. And so here is Paul in the synagogue of Antioch of Pisidia saying to those Jews in that synagogue, if you reject the gospel that I'm preaching to you, you'd better watch out. Why? Well, do you remember what happened in the days of Habakkuk? Remember judgment that came for rejecting the word of God? Same thing will happen here. You see, the Jews knew, like far too few people today know, that when a Jewish rabbi, when a Jewish speaker, when a Jewish writer quoted a part of a passage, they were bringing that entire prophetic passage to the mind of the listener, to the mind of the reader. So when Paul says, beware you despisers, behold you scoffers and wonder, for behold I work a work in your day, that a man would not believe, even a man foretold it to him. What's Paul doing? He's bringing the judgment context into the heart, into the mind of his listeners. He is telling them as clearly as could be told, you reject this message and judgment's coming. And that's why it bothers me, William. Well, I don't have time for this. Okay, I see we're out of time. But it involves more hermeneutic, okay? We'll discuss it another time as we continue, because we got more on this motif of blindness and deafness and refusal to hear and what it meant and how the New Testament writers applied it. So, with that said, I want to thank everyone again for joining us for Two Guys in the Bible, A Voice You Can Trust. Thank you. Thank you so much. Tell everyone about it. Lord willing, we'll see you again next week. Good night and God bless.
Thank you for joining the Two Guys in a Bible radio broadcast. On behalf of Dunn Preston and myself, we'd like to say have a very pleasant day and may God bless. Until next time, we'll see you on Fulfill Radio, A Voice You Can Trust.